When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Flying in the mountains, you know, sometimes they want you to be there and sometimes they don't. Every once in a while, when the wind is calm and like everything is just right, maybe 3% of the time I would say I feel like euphoric. It's like, oh, this is such a beautiful flight. Like this, I just feel like I'm a bird in the sky, you know? Otherwise, you're just like, you're in there in like a sardine can sometimes, like 100 degrees, and it's stressful and it's hard.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this episode with Denise Joy. Denise is one of four pilots for Colorado Parks and Wildlife, where she flies a small Cessna aircraft in rugged terrain, conducting wildlife surveys and carrying out fish drops, stocking pristine alpine lakes with trout and grayling. In this episode, we talk about Denise's life as a pilot. We explore what a wildlife pilot actually does and what the day-to-day job looks like. We talk about Denise's life outside of work and her love of trekking to the lakes she stocked from the air to actually go and fish them. We also look at Denise's past and how she got to where she is now. This conversation is something a little bit different from our usual episodes, and it's a fascinating insight into a whole different style of adventurous life. I also want to very briefly mention we've now launched the Adventure Podcast Plus, where free subscribers get access to a newsletter that features links, insights and opinions on the worlds of adventure and exploration. Paid subscribers get access to a whole load of new bonus content, including a monthly Q&A with a guest, access to filmed InVision podcasts, access to our shorter form podcast, The Dispatches, and subscriber-only posts and articles. To get involved, head to theadventurepodcast.substack.com. And finally, before we start, I'll just give a huge shout out to the Martin Moran Foundation, our charitable partner, who help people from disadvantaged backgrounds get outdoors, upskill, and fall in love with mountains. If you're in a position to, please consider donating to the foundation. Okay, over to Denise Joy. Let's start at the start. Logical place to start. Could you introduce yourself? Tell me who you are and what you do, whatever that means to you.
Gosh, my name is Denise Joy, and currently I'm a wildlife pilot for Colorado Parks and Wildlife. So I fly throughout the state of Colorado in the USA, and we do surrounding states as well. I'd say I'm a conservationist. I, in my spare time, am trying to get over to work for nonprofits for wildlife conservation in Africa. My background is flying backcountry in Alaska, St. Elias, and Denali Parks. I did a stint doing aircraft coordination in Antarctica, and recently just finished a little short documentary. It's a little 14-minute short documentary on the work that I do called Fight or Flight, produced by Gnarly Bay. And I'm just really happy to be here to chat with you, Matt.
Ace. So let's go back in time a little bit. and, you know, working, doing what you do now, I mean, it's an amazing job. It feels like one of those jobs that kind of has this glass ceiling that like is possible to get to. And I think, you know, knowing a bit about who you are and your past, and not a lot, just what I can find online and what's in the movie. What was your childhood like, and where did you grow up, and what were your experiences as a kid?
My childhood, gosh, that's a lot of questions actually, but is we moved a lot as kids. We moved 26 times before high school. So for me, nature was always sort of a co-regulator, you know, it was sort of just the one thing that was constant in the unconstant. Me being a wildlife pilot was definitely a journey. I knew really early on that I wanted to fly. That was sort of a coping strategy that we learn about in the film. But I always wanted to fly in Alaska. I grew up in New England, which is a lot of rural woods and mountains and the Appalachians. But I don't know. I always was just really attracted to Alaska, just that vast wilderness, untouched, endless, you know. And so it took me quite a long time to, you know, through my early adolescence, early adulthood, get my licenses. We can talk about more about that if you'd like. But when I was in Alaska, that's where I saw a wildlife pilot in action. I was actually flying in Denali, flying some tourists around the mountain. And below me on my left-hand shoulder, there was this wildlife. There was a Park Service pilot flying over some doll sheep. And once I saw that, I just knew I wanted to, I just knew I wanted to do that. And you're right. It is kind of a bubble. You know, there's not many people doing this anymore. A lot of natural resource pilots, because of technology advances with GPS collars instead of VHF collars and, you know, imaging that we're doing of wildlife, just the more the technology advances, the less pilots we're showing that are doing this. And also there is two kind of, I guess, sort of a, it's hard to find people who have the experience to do it as well. It's one of those jobs that you need the experience before you get the job, but you don't really get the experience until you do the work. So once I was in Alaska and I saw the Park Service pilot, I started volunteering overseas to try to get experience doing wildlife surveys. And so worked with some great folks with Pantera in Central America, doing jaguar studies and some macaw bird migration studies, and then went to Tanzania to try to get into some wildlife conservation work there. But that's when the Colorado Parks and Wildlife position opened up, and jumped on it. And that was 9 years ago. So that's kind of the fast version of how I got here. But it was tough. It was definitely a long road to get here for sure.
Yeah, sure. And I think, you know, I would like to go into the detail of some of that. But I guess my first question is, you said, was it training or wanting to even be a pilot and going off to Alaska eventually was part of a coping strategy? Coping with what, if I can ask?
I think, yeah. So my childhood, I've had adverse childhood experiences. So growing up, we moved quite a bit. We had some food insecurity sometimes, but I was a child of abuse, and which we go over a little bit in the film. So it's interesting when I do this Q&As of the film, a lot of people share very similar stories on flying. I think flight is a lot of things for people. There's a lot of reasons why people take the controls of a plane, but it's freedom, it's perspective. But I think there really is something special about taking the controls of an aircraft and being sort of, I guess, PIC of something. And I think just being especially a woman, I think of people who being the controls of an airplane is pretty powerful, because not many people have that kind of control in their own lives, in their own family, in their own communities, like being really like the person to make all the decisions and where all of that decision-making lies on them completely. And I think there's a lot of power in that. And so when I'm sharing my story, a lot of pilots share their sort of escapism, sort of similar stories of abuse and trying to regain control. And but I think for me that the flying just was that, was, you know, just that perspective There really is nothing like taking off and getting out of your tunnel vision of yourself and your life, you know, and just right away when I took off the first time, just seeing everyone else's life, you know, and it's just really introspective for me, just how many homes there are and stories there are and, you know, different, you know, challenges and triumphs. And I don't know, it's just, it's really amazing. Flying for me really does give me perspective on, I think, us as humans, but also to our human impact on the wilderness as well. So anyway, I think initially through my childhood, I think those are the things that really drove me to it.
Yeah. And, you know, goes without saying, I'm sure, but like, I'm, you know, sorry you experienced those things. It's horrendous. I think it's, but there's a sort of interesting, maybe not a good word to use, but there's an interesting kind of thing going on here. I think having interviewed a lot of people who've done very adventurous things, often it seems like they feel like they're running towards something, but having interviewed them and spoken to them a lot, it feels like actually maybe they're running away from something and they didn't realize that. It sounds like you did know that, like you weren't necessarily running, but you were seeking some form of control and some form of metaphorical escapism, and you found it in almost like a literal place.
I think what's interesting for me is when you're a child, you don't really have that sort of high level awareness, but like there was that escapism, right? That sort of feeling of flight. But what's interesting is that kind of full circle, the tools that I use to actually, you know, sort of help me through my childhood trauma are actually some of the most important tools that I use for the high risk flying that I do, you know, just like, just really that healing from trauma, you know, is just creating a really flexible, healthy nervous system. And you really need to have that when you're doing the sort of flying that we're doing, you know, coming in and out of that, sort of parasympathetic, sympathetic stages of just, you know, just you're constantly going in and out of that when you're flying. And so I think what's interesting is that it was something that helped me cope when I was a child, but then it was also something that like really kind of made me heal. I think something that's, yes, progress isn't really linear, you know? So it was a long journey at the beginning, but I guess for me, you know, what were your experiences yourself? You know, you're talking about, you know, going away from something and going towards something. Do you have something similar for an experience for yourself?
You're turning it on to me. I mean, my short answer is, I'll do it very succinctly. Yeah, I was badly bullied at school. I didn't know who I was. I was very insecure. And I left home at 16 and moved to the mountains. And I reinvented myself and pretended to be a big, brave, strong man. And then those things came true because I pretended for long enough. And then I realized that was this fragile armor because it wasn't actually true of me. And I wasn't big, brave, or strong really deep down. And I had to go on this journey through therapy of working out who I actually was. I'm quite vulnerable. I'm quite emotional. I can still be big, brave, and strong.
Right.
But acknowledging the vulnerability, I'm very emotional. I'm probably on some form of bipolar spectrum. And now going through therapy and learning that actually those things, I hate this phrase, but those things can be superpowers if they're used well. So whichever stage I find myself in when I wake up on the day, I can go, okay, I'm having one of those days today. Well, in which case we're going to do this, not that, because that would not go well. So yeah, that's my short answer.
No, that really resonates with me because I feel like when I started my healing journey, you know, when you grow up with adverse childhood experiences or even, you know, just, you know, prejudices are real. And so I think you feel like you're at a race and you're like 100 yards behind everyone else, right? You don't feel like you're really an equal. So sort of when I was a child, I was like, man, I feel like I'm really just missing something. Like, just, you know, like what we're kind of saying earlier, really, like the page isn't turning here. Like everyone just has a sort of key that's turning their door and like, you know, but I don't really feel like I'm on the same page there. And so that can be really discouraging. And I feel like what I learned is actually, gosh, those things that happened, actually kind of did give you superpowers, you know? You have a lot of strengths that I realize that other people don't have because of that. And I think I hate turning something, a horrible atrocity that you experienced, into, I guess a tool that's, you know, brings you, empowers you. But I really feel like it does, and it did for me at least. And so once I sort of reframed that in my head, you know, instead of like being a victim, but like, wow, these are things that are actually like making me a better person, a better pilot, you know, just having that really high situational awareness. Because when you're so, you know, when you're young and you're sort of always waiting for something dangerous to happen, you know, that can really transform into something that's beneficial as a pilot, because you're always wondering, like, what if something happens next, especially when you're flying in the mountains. But then obviously you have to sort of, you know, you can't be in a constant state of stress where it's debilitating. So what you do is you learn that, you know, that high situational or self-awareness, like, not being on overdrive, right? But like, you know, harnessing that to be actually beneficial, because it's not sustainable. You can't just constantly be in, you know, a cortisol rush all day. And and I really resonated with that. You know, I think it kind of can bring you a superpower.
Well, I really resonate with that, because I think that's one of the things I haven't talked about much, is like, you're totally right about the cortisol rush. Because I would say, like, not to be self-congratulatory, but like, I'm really good under pressure and really good in difficult scenarios or when things go wrong. And I think because of that, and I felt this like profound sense of control and almost like power, like not in a bad way, but like, I can do this. It became almost addictive. And so what happened was I was living in a perpetual state of like heightened awareness and stress because I could cope there. And right. It was actually when that wasn't there and I had to just be calm and be me and be a person, I struggled. I was uncomfortable because I had to actually be myself and look at myself. Right. And that was uncomfortable.
100%. The hardest thing for me to learn was to just to sit in discomfort. Just sitting there and be with it, you know, and like not distracting myself or, you know, but that was a huge tool. And that sounds really simple and not really like powerful, but it really is probably the hardest thing that I can do. Because I think, you know, people that thrive under pressure and thrive under that cortisol, you know, I think for me, I mean, that was home for me. That was just like regular for me. But again, like, you know, I wouldn't be able to be going to my job every day and just have no techniques on like ways to like just go in and out of that cortisol high, that sort of sympathetic stage. And so I guess I kind of equate it sometimes. Some jobs I do, like the surveys that we have for waterfowl, where you have to be on all the time. Like you're just sort of flying low level over the trees, and we have the biologist and the technician on board. And we're counting, you know, geese and waterfowl for our surveys. And that's a federal survey throughout the country, but we do it in the state. You're just sort of like on this high alert the whole time. And that's sort of, for me, like a long distance ultra runner, sort of, I have to get my mentality around like, okay, we're going to be here for the long haul. But where we do the fish drops that you saw in the film, you know, where we're flying into these, you know, cirques, into these lakes, like this sort of just like that's sort of more of like a hit scenario. Like, okay, I'm going to go in here and I'm going to get everything that I have. And then once I, you know, clear the obstructions, get out of the area, clean up the aircraft, I can sort of come down and, you know, bring my heart rate down, you know, so it's sort of just, you know, getting that breath work done and like, you know, regaining, I guess, yeah, just going back into parasympathetic. So like, I'm not completely exhausted by the time I'm landing. And because you can, there's definitely a burnout stage. And I see, especially for people flying and natural resource flying, and, you know, there's wildlife surveys that are done, but there's a lot of folks that are doing wildfire support and, you know, other really stressful jobs. And that the burnout is something that I see, and it's real, you know, and how do we mitigate that? It's not... That's kind of something that I want to start talking more in our industry, because, you know, it doesn't get talked about. You know, we talked about, you know, when we're flying, we're supposed to be physically and mentally fit to fly, but no one's really giving us a handbook on that. So anyway, I digress, but I feel like that was really key for me to have like a sustainable career in this, and not burn out. But
I mean, you don't digress. I think it's really interesting. I also think it's kind of different in a way to like adventure and journeys of self. Like those things, people can get a bit obsessed with them and they can experience burnout in lots of ways, particularly like long distance runners, ultras is the perfect example. But, you know, what you're describing with the role that you do, and I think in a minute we'll go on to that in detail, but like disaster response, wildfire support, like what you do, all these things are, you know, jobs and careers of purpose. There's like an altruistic intent there that is of service. And so I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but there can be this need to like say to yourself, well, okay, I'm exhausted, but actually we need to do the work because the work matters. It's not like, oh, I can just take today off because I'm tired. That can be dangerous, right?
Well, we 100% do. And I think I've had to learn, I think the hardest thing, the most important thing you have to learn as a pilot is like the go, no go decision. And we hear, you know, we talk about that a lot in our industry. I feel like this is interesting. I have so much passion for the work. So there is that side on like wanting to get the work done, but my job really isn't doing the work. My job really is landing at the airport and getting everybody home safe. Like that's my job. So I sort of work my way sort of from that landing scenario backwards. So whenever I take off, you know, I know I have a sort of for that day, and that changes every day, depending on how I'm eating, how I'm sleeping, how I'm doing. I know I only have a certain amount of energy for that day, but like I know that I'm going to have to go back home and land. Right. And if it's blowing really hard or it's high density altitude and the plane isn't performing very well, like I know that I'm going to have my handful, right? So I need to have to, like a little piggy bank for when I land. And so I can't give everything that I have every day. And I think that's, I think that energy management is tough, but you need to do it, you know, you just otherwise. So I think this was the job actually flying in Alaska and the other work that I've done. You're pushed really hard. Because you're not making money unless if the prop's not turning. And what I really love about the work that we do here is, you know, this isn't life or death, right? You know, we're not just bringing someone, to the hospital. Like I don't need to do this every day. So I never get pushback or pressure from anyone, which is pretty awesome, you know, but there's definitely pulses of work that we do that have deadlines, and you feel pressure and just because you love the work. So I'm not saying it's not there, but I feel like with experience, I've come to a point where I'm really comfortable saying no. And, but I think that's a really powerful thing for any, you know, especially a woman or someone, you know, yeah, any kind of minority can do is to have that kind of strength. Cause I think for me, kind of a sideline, you know, just, this whole process with the film, with doing these podcasts, way outside my comfort zone. I'm an introvert. I'm a very private person. So, but I do feel like, you know, when we talk about flying and that sort of escapism and that healing, I think one of the reasons when I started making the film, you know, I felt really alone on my journey. I felt really alone, you know, when I started, you know, just introspection and self-awareness and healing from that trauma. This is 20 years ago. This is before the internet and the apps that we have online now. And for everything that I hate about smartphones, like they make it really easy to get a little bit of help, you know, for people who are embarrassed to ask for help. So at first, when I started making the film, it was really like, God, I just really want one person to not feel alone, right? I think that's why we share stories, right? We share stories because I feel like we connect through stories. And I feel like through connection, we heal. But I feel like the more that I talk about this, it really isn't about making people feel less alone in their journey. I feel like the more that we share stories, it gives them license to talk about their own story, right? Like they feel like, oh, I can talk about this too. And I feel like once you start talking about it, because for me talking about it's really challenging, that gives you a whole nother level of like, power and strength. And I feel like that just through this whole process, like I was saying, like this filmmaking and podcasting, like it's a journey too, you know, like having a voice on this process isn't easy, but it's empowering for sure. Do you feel that way too? Like for your podcasting? Like, do you, I mean, just like,
well, you're doing what most people don't do, which is turn it around on me, which makes me really uncomfortable. But I have to acknowledge it, because otherwise I'd be a massive hypocrite, because I spend my life trying to get people to tell me their stories and to be honest and vulnerable and real. So obviously I have to do it too.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to spend too much time talking, but like, I found so much, I don't like the phrase, I found so much power, but the response online when I have been vulnerable or honest, particularly from men, has been amazing. You know, talking, whether it's about bullying in the past or therapy or struggling with becoming a parent or sexuality or any of these things, like 99.9% of the response has been like overwhelmingly positive.
That's great.
That feels good for two reasons. Like, one, it feels nice to feel like you're helping people. And two, and let's not hide from this fact, like validation feels good, right?
Right.
Like, it's nice to have people go, I agree with what you said. That was important. And you go, oh, okay, cool. Well, I'll carry on saying those things then. That feels really nice.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. No lies about that. We are tribal. We are in community, and feeling like welcomed and seen is pretty big, you know? I think a lot of people, one thing that we couldn't really touch a lot about it on the film, and because there really wasn't a lot of time, but I feel like mental health awareness is becoming like really big, especially since COVID. And I think for the first time, pilots are talking about that since COVID. And I wanted to share my struggles through my journey, but I couldn't share it without also sharing that like pilots don't talk about this. Like it's incredibly scary, and people, are still really, you know, have not only fear, but because of just like, well, if I share things and that will, you know, have a detriment to my career. So I feel like with documentaries, what I see with like athletes and other people that are really high stature and celebrities sharing their difficulties, I feel like there are sectors in our community where it's easier to share those things. It doesn't have a detriment to their livelihood as much as others, I think. And I think it's important when we talk about that to realize, wow, it's going to be a little bit more challenging for some people to be vocal.
Yeah.
For all these, for different reasons. So I think, yeah, I still have those same fears because of, you know, I remember like reaching out to all my mentors and I'm like, am I going to never be hired again? Is this going to hurt my career? Like, what should I say? What shouldn't I say? And it was just so funny how much validation I needed from my mentors, like in aviation, like, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Like, and just, so I definitely needed that too. And once I had that support, you know, you just feel a little bit more comfortable. It's like dipping your toe in. You know, I don't jump in, you know, for these kinds of things. I kind of dip my toe in and feel it out. And, I have that as well. And so far people have shared really positive things and that makes me want to talk more. And honestly, if I didn't hear positive things, I probably wouldn't want to talk more, which I don't know if that's self-serving or not. I think it's just, I'm still learning. I'm still getting comfortable with it. So
no, anyway. I think it's very human. Like, I think I often see, how do I phrase this without getting in trouble? I'll just say it. I think like particularly white men of a certain background just have this like self-assured confidence that everything they say matters, is important and is right. Whereas others of us who aren't from that background or aren't white men actually tend to have a lot more imposter syndrome and think like, I regularly think, why does anybody care what I have to say about anything? Like, it's just, I'm so underqualified to comment on all this stuff. Just why do I speak? So then when you do, and people say, hey, I heard that and that mattered to me, you go, oh, okay. There's another little piece of permission I can add to my permission jar. Keep talking. I'm like, okay, I need that. I do. I could pretend I don't, but I do.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying is so important. And even saying it out loud is brave, but doing it is braver. Is like, you know, I think it is a good thing. And I think lots of these industries, you know, you're obviously in the world of aviation, but whether it's the military, whether it's outdoor, like expedition style stuff, speaking up about mental health is massive, because there's the stark irony to, like, if you're in the special forces or a pilot or leading expeditions, and you talk about how you've had mental health struggles in the past, you're just like struck off or blacklisted. And it's like, hang on, are we pretending that everybody who works in these industries is like solid as a rock in their head?
Right.
Because that is so not the case. Like, why can we not create a culture where actually I have had mental health problems in the past and I have a really good handle on them because I sought help. So now I'm much more of a solid practitioner.
Right.
I'm not for the pot at work.
No, I really, 100%. I feel like there needs to be more of a prevention versus an intervention. You know, it's interesting. So where I am, there's 4 military bases. So people have talked to me on, gosh, that's, you know, their experience was so similar. And I mean, it's just not possible. I mean, we're human. So even if you didn't have adverse childhood experiences, or, you know, you had a great childhood, like, we're all going to deal with life. We're all going to lose somebody that we love. You know, like, this is not a permanent place on this planet. And so those losses are real. And so, you know, if you weren't taught those really healthy coping strategies, or you have a, you know, a really high emotional intelligence, which isn't bad, isn't it? You know, we're just, some people just didn't have a young adulthood where they were taught those things. I knew for me, I wasn't taught those things. I had to seek those things out. But yeah, I mean, so at some point you're going to be dealing with some really big traumatic event, and, you know, not everyone has those skills. You don't have those skills coming out into the world. So I want to really push that, you know, these aren't taboo skills to have, you know, just reaching out for even, like, you know, health coaching and, therapy. And, you know, there's just so many different, there's so much more vocabulary than you have a mental health problem and you need, you know, to seek, you know, intervening therapy. Like, there's prevention too. There's always, and for me, I think for me, it's super interesting. Like, I love learning about those things anyway. So for me, it's just like, I get jazzed about it, about reading, you know, certain books, and just, because it's constantly being updated. You know, for me, it was like creating a user manual for my body, and it's constantly being updated because new research comes out, new science comes out, new methodologies. And I don't really subscribe to one thing or drink the Kool-Aid to one thing. You know, it's like,
yes,
I kind of dab and take what, like, kind of resonates with me too. So, yeah, anyway, it's, I hope that by sharing little bits here and there, people in my, yeah, people feel like they can, you know, go on their journey as well.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Yeah. And I think as well, so much of this is in the phrasing, right? Like, I have a few friends who've approached me and said, oh, you know, you talk about it so vocally these days. Like, I always thought I should go to therapy, but I just can't make myself. And I say, well, then don't go to therapy. Go and get some coaching. Like, call it whatever you want.
Right.
It's the same thing.
Right.
You know, you're basically just trying to make yourself better in some way or another. And, you know, most good coaches will look at your strengths and weaknesses. It's like, well, that's just therapy. We just call it, therapy is such a dirty word. Call it counseling. Call it coaching.
I know.
I care.
I know. I'm curious, yeah. You know, I don't, like, I'm just, like, you know, across the pond, your culture, do you feel like since COVID, like, your culture is changing with the phraseology? And, like, I know for us it is here. So,
yeah, definitely. And I think that there are some people who we have to thank for that in different sectors. But I mean, you know, whether they're celebrities or whether they're influencers or whether they're, you know, people with voices in echo chambers, it's becoming more normal to talk about mental health struggles or imposter syndrome. And, you know, in my world, the way that I look, the way that I am, you know, having these, like, big ex-military guys who are the, you know, epitome of the strong, brave, stoic man that I always thought I wanted to be, come out and say, I basically got booted out of the special forces because I had a mental health breakdown. And then I went and fixed my head and now I'm a better person. You go, huh, okay, well,
right.
It gives me permission to do that. And
yeah,
I think the culture's changing quite fast. It's got a long way to go, but I think, I don't know how old you are, I sense we're a similar age, but like our generation, I think, is so much more open to talking about it than our parents' generation.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, my mom, I'm 42. My mom is like, she's from the silent generation. She had me late. So there was no vocabulary and there was not even a way for her to talk about anything. So, I'm happy that these discussions are happening.
So I'll get in trouble if I don't, you know, do this, because I love the deep and heavy, and I love doing these, you know, the proper. I just feel like this is real conversation with real people, and you know, we're sort of both, maybe I don't want to speak for you, but sort of pretending that tens of thousands of people aren't going to listen to this, but they are, and
I'm here trying we to are pretend that.
Our souls.
I know. I'm really trying to pretend that.
We can always delete it. No, we mustn't do that. So let's get, like, not back on track, but let's turn this around a little bit. I would love to know what a wildlife pilot does. What does that actually mean? You know, you've hinted at it a bit, but what's the job?
Shoot. So I think quickly, it's pretty diverse. We survey, we track, we transport wildlife. I think a lot of people think a big game. We do. But we do conservation species, waterfowl, avian species. So we have pulses of work throughout the year for our surveys. There's four of us pilots in Colorado, and we have four aircraft. I work, you know, directly with a biologist for their research, essentially what we do for the research for two things, for conservation, but also for management. So we survey each game management unit. The state is divided into game management units for hunters. And we survey the, this is for the big game. We survey the big game to see every year, like, how many males there are, how many females, how many babies, you know, for different animals, and see the health of the population, and how they're doing. They modulate that. And that's how they decide to, allocate certain hunting licenses, like a number of hunting licenses. So they're not just, so they have science to back that up. I'm not paid through taxes through the state. I'm paid through like hunting licenses and fishing licenses. So Colorado Parks and Wildlife is Department of Natural Resource. But we work both for the conservation and for the management of wildlife. And that actually got merged before I started 9 years ago. It used to be separate, the park side and the, I guess, the division of wildlife side. So anyway, we have pulses of work. So some, like, we just, in the wintertime, we do the waterfowl surveys, we do the nesting surveys for hawks. Springtime, we do capture. So we capture the animals to collar them for GPS collars, so we can see their migration, so we can build migration corridors, which is really big right now in Colorado, so they can walk over highways, which is really important. I'm not sure about your audience, but we want to make sure that wildlife aren't being encapsulated in certain areas, so they have genetic diversity. As I'm talking about this, I am not a biologist. I got my degree in aviation sciences, so I know a lot about certain things, but I'm not a professional. But I'm passionate about it. So I guess, so we do capture work right now. So the helicopter captures, and then we do the overflights for them. So we monitor their flights and we, you know, find groups for them to capture and make sure, you know, when they're working, we're communicating with them on the health of the animals, you know, where they're running. As we're working with wildlife, you're constantly wanting to make sure you're not endangering them when you're working with them, right? We're not pushing them into gullies or to fences, or we're really cognizant of where we're working them in that area. And also too, like for me, I'm watching the helicopter and telling that, you know, pilot, like, okay, you have an antenna over here or a power line, be careful. And just, you kind of have a sort of high level workshop going on there. So then the summertime, we do our pronghorn surveys, which like antelope out in the plains. And so they're a tough animal to survey because they are really fast. They're so it's tough. You know, you're flying under 400 feet close to the ground. We operate on a low-level waiver from our FAA, the government. There's regulations on how close you're able to fly to, you know, cities and buildings and such, but we operate on a low-level waiver. So we have to make sure that we're being really cognizant and being really mindful on that and not taking advantage. And yeah, it's tough. I'm not going to lie. You're flying in an aircraft in a three-dimensional space, trying to maneuver an animal herd so the biologist can look at them and speciate them and get their sexes. And, you know, they're running fast and all making sure that you're not going to hit anything and they're not going to hit anything. And so there's a lot of moving pieces for that to happen. And so that happens during the summer and then during the fall, when the winds get nice, you know, we have our, you know, really high mountains in Colorado. What we stock with high, our high alpine lakes, we stock with trout for anglers. And so we do that in the fall. And that pretty much lasts until October. And then it's wintertime and we kind of just rinse and repeat. So the film goes over a lot of the aerial fish stocking and how we do that. And we actually have a helicopter fly with me through the air, which is pretty amazing that that came together. That was a really hard thing to collaborate. And Lindsay Hagen, the director, did an amazing job. So you really get to see a really good picture on the aerial stocking in the film, but there's a lot of the animal surveys that, you know, we couldn't quite touch upon. So that's kind of what I do. I mean, it sounds like I was talking to someone the other day, like for every hour that I fly, I probably have about 2 hours in a cubicle, like prepping for a flight, you know, just getting ready. It's a lot of paperwork. I don't want your viewers to think like all I'm doing is like flying these, you know, these really interesting missions. Like there's definitely some days where it's a lot of boring paperwork. So I will say that for my job.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure that that's true of a lot of like really exciting jobs, right? Like I have the same thing with filmmaking. People are like, wow, you get to go and climb these mountains in Alaska. I'm like, yeah, I did 6 weeks of pre-production before that one. And, you know, spent 3 months pitching it before that. But yeah, it was great. No, it's fascinating. And I think what's really interesting about you, just from, you know, what I saw online is, you don't just fly around these places, right? You spend time on foot out in these places. You're actually an active, like, outdoors person.
Very much, yeah. That's really why I love what I do is, you know, nature was such a huge part of my childhood healing, and it still is. It's probably the most important thing for me, and so I really want to make sure that stays around for a long time just because of how much it means to me. Two things. One thing that I learned with the filmmaking, how much time you talk about your pre-production stuff. Like I had no idea. It took 4 years to do 14 minutes. Like it's like, I had no idea how much back of the house for like sound and lighting and cinematography and producing. And it's just like there are some audience members, storytellers do not get paid enough and they work their tails off. Like I will say this, like this is just really impressed. It was eye-opening. But what I do, so when I started flying, we stock almost over 400 alpine lakes, which are between 12 and 14,000 feet high. And I should be able to do that conversion, but I can't. I didn't do my homework. I'm sorry. I feel like, so when I started, we were flying over and I was flying with my pilot. I was getting trained. This was probably year two or three that I was on. You get trained for a few years before you're set free to do it solo. And we do this work solo because it's so high risk. I was just saying, I think I made an offhand comment like, oh, wouldn't it be so cool to hike to each one of these lakes? And I think he was sort of like, yeah, why don't you go do that? Why don't you, because I had no idea how many lakes there are. But I've been working on it pretty hard for like 7 years, and I've gotten to over 100. And I'm pretty proud of that, but I will say I am not going to go to each one of these lakes because there's just too many. But I go up, I stalk them with a trap, but then I go up and I fly fish them after. And it's kind of a cool, like, little loop, you know, it's a close the deal. And I love it, you know, it brings me out there. And so, I mean, I came to Colorado in 2006 and was, you know, hiking a lot, not necessarily like knocking off the 14ers, we call them, like the 14,000 footers. But this new lake thing is kind of my jam for sure. I dig it.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. I mean, like you say, it's like full circle. It must be so interesting, the contrast between, like, because I have worked quite a lot with helicopters and, you know, been flown into environments and then set out on foot, and then you cover ground over 3 days that would take, you know, 10 minutes in a helicopter.
Oh, sure.
Just for you, that contrast of like flying to all these lakes so quickly, stocking them, and then walking into one of them and spending time there. It's like the ultimate juxtaposition of experience of a single landscape, right?
Yeah. Well, I definitely, the best advice I got flying in Alaska from backcountry pilot was to hike to where you want to land backcountry, right? Because your visual depiction on things when you're flying, it's going so fast and it looks very, very different. You know how, you know, and I've said this before, like a lot to people, like, you look, you know, what looks like gravel to you when you're flying is really boulders, you know? So like, or just the color of the sand on what it actually is when it's wet or not wet, or just, you know, I think when you're doing a lot of off airport landings in Alaska, that's really important. For me, there's so much microclimates in Colorado, you know, just like we can have weather systems move across, but each lake is its own weather system and how the winds are operating in that cirque. And that's, so when I started actually flying and doing these missions, I would hike to them at first. I wasn't fishing them at first. I was kind of doing my homework. I was just like, you know, it's really great to just stand there and sit there and really look at how these winds are operating in that cirque. You know, how is that going to affect me as a pilot? And, you know, many years before I started, we had a pilot that was lost doing this operation from a downdraft, and just really using, so I was kind of going up there to put that in my toolkit, you know, just because, yeah. So when we fly, we really sort of, I wouldn't say like micromanage, but every little cirque is like its own little organism. And we really kind of take time to look at it and witness it. Cause the more I get down closer to the lake, the less options that I have. And I'm not giving away all my outs, right? You never do that as a pilot, but it gets more and more high risk the closer that you get into that cirque. And so, anyway, each one is its own little entity and its own little flavor for sure. So it was helpful in the beginning to hike to them. But then, yeah, then I started to fish them and it became, I don't know, it became more full circle after that for sure.
Yeah, it's so cool. And I think it's interesting as well, because I mean, this kind of goes without saying, and I don't want to take anything away from what anybody else does, but like, you're not flying, you know, from Paris to Lisbon or New York to Toronto with people in the plane, right? Like those things, it sounds like what you're doing is so heavily regulated and it's high skill and all this stuff, the same as those big kind of passenger flights. But like you said, you know, some, you lost somebody, and I've heard all sorts of stories about people crashing, you know, bush pilots and people like that. Like it feels like a completely different game. There's no runway to get landing on. And I guess what I'm asking in a way is like, is that part of the fun? Do you need that danger element? Do you need that risk and jeopardy? Or is that just par for the course?
For me, it's par for the course. I know pilots who that's an exhilarating part for them, you know, but I think we talked earlier about that sort of cortisol rush, you know? And so for me, it's interesting. Like I have a huge admiration for aviators and what they do, but I'm not really, I would never find me at a museum. Like the aircraft, the tire size, how short and how long it can land. Like, for me, it really is about the mission. And I'm not, like, same for you. Like, I'm not saying that anyone that really gets jazzed about that, I am like, I'm super thrilled. That's your passion. But for me, the work is the passion, like what we're doing. And so, so for me, that the mountain flying and everything, like, I mean, I'm not, the high risk operations that we do, let me rephrase that, I endure because the work is important to me. Flying in the mountains, I mean, you know, sometimes they want you to be there and sometimes they don't. And so it's like every once in a while when the wind is calm, you know, and like everything is just right, buttoned up, and like everything is just like smooth sailing, you know, I can take like maybe 3% of my flights, 3% of the time, I would say, like, I feel like euphoric. It's like, oh, this is such a beautiful flight. Like this, I just feel like I'm a bird in the sky, you know? Otherwise, you're just like, you're in there in like a sardine can sometimes, like 100 degrees, you know, or getting bumped, or, you know, just working hard, and it's stressful and it's hard. And it's so, I guess, for me, it is about the work. But I will say, I feel like sometimes with people, especially two things, when you turn your passion into a job, that can be challenging sometimes, right? So learning to navigate that, I think, was hard too, right? I didn't want to lose my passion for the work because I did it every day, right? You're just sort of like clocking in and clocking out. I didn't want to get complacent because I was doing it every day, right? Like, what am I here for? Like, there was that element, but also I think sometimes too, I think it can be dangerous when you tie your identity to what you do, right? Because especially for pilots, I could lose my medical at any time, you know? I could have a heart condition or diabetes or something that I would have no control over, and I would lose my ticket to fly. And for a lot of pilots, that's really hard for them because their identity is tied into what they do. And so I think too, sometimes when we talk about being very lucky that we get to work with what we're passionate about, I'm really cognizant with that. That's not a permanent thing either. And I have to be really careful on not tying my identity to being a wildlife pilot. Like, that's, you know, who knows what will happen to me or my future, and being okay with the change, right? Giving myself agency and flexibility for that change too.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's such like a wise thing to say, right? Like, it's that looking at that, I don't know, the way I try to think about it sometimes is, if this all ended tomorrow, would that be okay?
Right.
You know, not my life, but my career. And I kind of go, well, I've done more than I ever thought I would. So like, I have to think yes. And, you know, yes, it'd be difficult, but it sounds like that could be true of you as well. You know, the experiences you've had kind of against the odds to get there, and that we haven't talked in detail about the journey to get there, but, you know, working out in Africa and going up Antarctica and all these things, it's like you've done so much amazing stuff that you probably never dreamt you'd be able to do. Yeah, I'm sure you want to do it for another 30 years, but one day it's going to stop.
Yeah, it's true. No, it's... It was really challenging to get here. And, you know, I feel very, very fortunate that I got to experience the things that I got to experience, but also there was a lot of tenacity with it too. I definitely was pretty tenacious on trying to make it happen. But I feel like I'm at that point, like you, if it does end tomorrow, you know, I would be okay with it. You know, I have to be okay with it. But did you want, I mean, go ahead.
I was just going to, I was debating whether or not to ask the question, but I'm gonna. I think there's this thing around like chasing dreams and achieving dreams. And there's this super cheesy quote from Prince where it's like, somebody said to him, like, you know, you're like 3 times platinum. Like, what's it feel like? You know, what are you going to do now? He's like, what am I going to do now? He said, man, I've been to the top of the mountain. There's nothing there. And then I'm like, it sounds so cynical and so pessimistic, but in a way I understand it. It's like, is achieving everything you wanted to achieve ever enough? Or is there always the next thing? And I think some of us are really good at that. Some of us, me, are really bad at that. And I guess my question is like, has achieving everything you set out to achieve ultimately made you happy?
One thing that I really regret, I was on this sort of like really fast, hard course to getting my licenses. And during that tenacious stage, I didn't give myself any credit, right? It was like checking the boxes. And that's really hard for me now because, you know, I did some really, I checked some really nice boxes along the way. But for me, it was that chase. I think you talked about earlier, it was chasing like the next thing. And then my first license I got, well, great. Okay. Now I need the next one and the next one and the next one. Yeah. And during that chase, I just feel so bad that I didn't give myself just the time and just to like celebrate with friends and family and really soak it in, you know. It was just, I was always looking to the next thing. And I think now, you know, I want to give myself that time. I want to, for me during my journey, a lot of that too was that box, checking that box is never going to make me feel whole. That box is never going to make me feel like a better person or my complete self, right? It's like, it's the internal work. And I think that's why I share that in the film. Like all the things that I've done flying, I've done some amazing things. Like I'm more proud of the internal work that I've done because no matter what I have, no matter what external things that I'm going to check in my life, right? Like my wholeness and my self-worth is not connected to those things, whereas before they were, if that makes sense. And that took me a while to get there. And I can say, like, I am really thrilled that I'm at that place in my life where my external achievements or failures are not connected to my self-worth. And so, yeah, I think that chasing for me, I still have dreams, yeah, and I still chase, but it's a different walk for sure.
I totally agree. Again, like I think, and it takes so long to work it out sometimes. And I think some people never do. Like there are so many things you can't control when it comes to that word that I hate, success. Like what does success mean? Like I didn't get a job 2 weeks ago that I really wanted. I came second.
Oh, sorry.
And well, but then I was grumpy for an hour and then yeah. I was like, hang on, I nearly got that job, like that insane job. Like, and everything I did to get that job, I felt like I did a good job of it. And it went to somebody more qualified, more experienced. And so I'm going to use the word better than me. And like, that's okay. Cause I'm not the best at everything in the world. Like I'm,
right.
You know, this person was older than me. It's okay. Like, it's fine. Mm-hmm. What an amazing thing to like be in the running for it. And I didn't get it. And that's okay. Like, sure. I'd like the money and I'd like the experience, but hey, it's okay. And I think like at risk of turning this into a self-help episode, it's like looking back at these things and saying, what am I proud of with these things that I've done versus the, you know, the awards I didn't win or the money I didn't make or the success I didn't get from an extrinsic perspective. And that like, that is so powerful. If you can get into that headspace as a kind of known daily constant, it sort of makes you invincible.
I agree. Now that when you said that resonates, like one, I love your, you know, just what you said on that person, you know, was more qualified. And I think a couple things people told me, sometimes you get jealous, we're human and that happens. But someone gave me great advice on that could just be a feeling on they're in a position in their life where you want to be, right? But then the flip side of that too is someone else was talking about something to me like this, like you can't be everything and you can't experience everything. And so I have FOMO. Like I definitely are like, man, I wish I was there. I wish I was doing that, you know, but I think too, I'm at this point in my life, like I know that I'm not going to be able to do everything and everything. And the only way, so like, I really embrace FOMO on like I have it and I'm okay with it. I need to have it because like, I need to let go of things. I'm not going to have more time in my life. You know, I think time management for so long for me was like trying to cram in as much as I could do in a day to get where I want to be. And now it's like, I love taking things off my list because I can't do 10 things today. I can only do two and I want to do these things really well. And so I don't know those, when you were talking, those are the kind of the two things that I was thinking about, just like, yeah, you can't have it all. You can't.
Well, I'm really conscious of time and this has been so interesting. I mean, I love this sort of conversation.
Good.
But
it was a pleasure.
I ask the same two questions at the end of every interview. Every conversation, I should say.
I should have researched this.
Well, I like it when people haven't. The first is, what scares you?
Ooh, I really wish you told me you didn't have any questions on this thing. what's the next one?
You got to do that one first. I'm sorry.
Oh, come on. Come on. What scares me? I can't. Sorry.
I'm going to let you off. It's maybe the first time ever.
Really?
what brings you hope?
I think that, what brings me hope is when people come together. And what brings me fear is when people don't.
I'll take that. Well, this has been amazing. Thank you so much. We'll end it there.
Okay. That was good.
So good.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch, then you can email me at matt@terraincognita.studio. And finally, as always, please do leave us an honest review on iTunes. They're a big help, and it really does help us bring the podcast to a wider audience.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.